Doris Graf's with me, and we're interviewing Dr. Herman Gordon. It is February 16th, 1990, and we're taping for the National Council of Jewish Women, the Pittsburgh section, for the Oral History Project. Dr. Gordon, could you please state your name and your birth date?
My name is Herman Gordon, born March 26th. 1912, on a Monday.
All right. Dr. Gordon, we spoke previously about your naval career as an officer in World War II, and you gave us some interesting information. Would you be willing to discuss what opinions you have about being Jewish as a naval officer in World War II? Was that something unusual? And what type of experience it was?
Being a naval officer, of course, was very unusual because it put you in a position of authority, of high esteem, and a lot of responsibility. There was a characterization that you felt you had to live up to as being a gentleman and an officer. The experience itself was so different than being in civilian life. Everything was categorized with authority over authority and lots of regimentation. Aside from that, the experience itself was completely new. You were in a war, and you were close to all the involvements, the history, the logistics, the reasons for being in it, and you felt that you were a personal part of a ominous situation that pervaded the whole world, where it was touch and go, and you knew that if you lost, you would be enslaved, because the Germans and the Japs were remorseless and cruel and extremely discriminatory, as you know what they did to all the Jews. Being a Jew didn't make me feel any different in the Navy than I felt when I was in school. Growing up as a youth in a melting pot, I had no experiences of anti-Semitism or even racial differences. It was just a big, happy family of many hues. When you got to college, you suddenly were fragmented, as I had stated before, into Jewish fraternities, Protestant, Catholic, and so forth, and so you were stigmatized, and you came into contact with provincial thinking, people that came from small towns and had illusions that were unbelievable. I had a girl say to me in the Navy, a girl from the South, "Gordon, you don't have horns." She was astonished that I didn't have horns. And while I was aboard ship, I had chance to peruse the literature emanating from many churches, and I was shocked. It was a continuous onslaught on the Jew, putting us in a position of evil. Now, realizing that this had gone on for thousands and thousands of years, you knew that there was a discrimination there that was just unthinking, hard to penetrate. So you were definitely aware of the fact that you were a Jew. As far as being a officer, There was no discrimination. You had a position. You were promoted automatically. I assume that as you got up to the extremely high ranks of admiral and otherwise, that plenty of anti-Semitism came into play. But at my level, there was certainly no overt. Now, what I felt with my fellow officers, that was the natural sensitivity that was created from the awareness of the persistent anti-Semitism. We lived at Bainbridge. We lived in a room comprising, that we shared with another officer, two beds and a desk. Sometimes my roommates were Jewish, sometimes they were Gentile. And I had Jewish roommates with whom I had nothing in common and very unhappy. At times I had Jewish roommates that I did find a common denominator. But when I shared a room with some of the one particular, well, I had twice, three times, I shared a room with a Gentile. Two of them came from the Philadelphia area, the main line, that was the more social level. And very, very nice, very courteous to me, but I knew that I was not included. Never once did we go out on a date. There was no consorting after hours. It was just a very polite, formal cohabitation. But I felt that difference. Now, on the other hand, I had a roommate by the name of John Shelton, a line officer. Line officers rarely mixed with the dental or medical officers. He was in charge of the athletic department. We developed a marvelous friendship. He was an All-American football player, quite popular. Certainly did not need me for companionship or friendship. But he made me feel that I was very important to him. And never once did I feel the difference because I was a Jew. But subconsciously, that thought was still there. It was very hard to get rid of it. And one day I had a chance to get my own room, and I took that chance, feeling perhaps that John was very sensitive, very courteous, and perhaps I was interfering with his life. So I moved out. About 2 weeks later, John called and said there was the availability of a room in the Old Tome Prep School, which was a much finer building with a lot of niceties, and he asked if I would move in with him. I had tears in my eyes, and I agreed because I knew that John really loved me for myself. And after the war, we kept in contact. One day, when I was out in the islands on my ship, a small flotilla approached. John Shelton was captain, and he radioed in to find out if Lieutenant Herman Gordon was aboard. And when he found out that I was, he visited from his ship to ours for a few days, and we just had a wonderful time. And I knew that many of the other officers, I just sensed that they felt, who's this fellow seeking out the Jew? So you were just made to feel that you were Jewish. And I spent a lot of that 4 years trying to be exemplary, trying to show that Jews were fine people, and they didn't have horns and they didn't have a tail. But the very fact that I had to force myself into this kind of behavior meant that I was very conscious of being a Jew, but not just because I was in the Navy. I mean, I felt the same situation at college. And one day, I was pretty athletic, and I was involved with a lot of the Gentile boys who were athletic, and we got along famously. But one night they had a party, and I was excluded. I didn't say anything about it, but maybe a couple months later, Romanelli, who was a great runner, athlete, and very friendly with me, was discussing why Jewish people kept to themselves. So I told him in no uncertain terms, you had a party, I was excluded. I loafed with you fellows all day long, and am I supposed to go seeking my Jewish friends at night with my tail between my legs? He says, oh, well, they thought maybe you wouldn't fit in. I says, you thought I wouldn't fit in, and then you have enough nerve to tell me that we keep together, that we're clannish? I says, don't you realize it's your very actions that force us into that position? So this is what you were aware of. And so, as I say, most of my time was spent proving what fine people Jews were. My roommate aboard ship was from Virginia, extremely cultured. His family had a villa in Italy. He had won a prize for his masterful knowledge of the Italian language. He was always designing architecturally styled homes that would, in those days, cost $500,000 to build. And I sensed that he had very, very little contact with Jews. But Ned Reynolds was a very cultured, very very much devoid of any anti-feelings that I knew of in any way. We spent 2 years together as roommates, and real friends. When I was married, he sent me a Paul Revere silver bull as a wedding present. That's after I had left the service. So I knew that he was a truly fine person. I dated a Gentile girl for a couple years while I was in the Navy. Our associations were mostly with Gentile people. And I had no feeling of being excluded or different. So I would say that the the anti-Semitism that existed in the Navy was no different than what existed in the outside world. And they could not pick on me, they could not discriminate on me, they couldn't do things that were contrary to the law or contrary to your natural expression of freedom, because you were an officer, you had authority. And most of my control was over others rather than others having control over me. But you were coming in contact with people from everywhere with great ignorance.
What do you think it was like at the enlisted level?
At the enlisted level, I would assume that you found more overt action, because the educational level wasn't as high. The proximity of enlisted men in larger groups, I'm sure you found, I wasn't aware of it, but I'm sure that it must have been more noticeable.
And at the higher level, we find very few Jewish names. Was that because?
Well, at the extremely high level, a lot of these people were Naval Academy people. And the number of Jews that came from the Naval Academy was very small. So naturally, at the higher levels, it became more political. At the lower levels, it was not. In fact, when I went into the service, the blacks were discriminated against to the degree that they could not be in combat units, they could not be officers, they weren't on equal terms with the white boys. In the Navy, every one of them were sent to a steward school, which meant that they kept your rooms for you. They were your servants. They were your... Now, on the ball field, we played ball with them, whether they were officers or not, and there you consorted. But the... they were kept to themselves, even aboard ship. They slept in different quarters, so you didn't have that mixture. I made a painting once of a color dance that was up at Bainbridge, and they were all doing the jitterbug, but everyone was in steward school. Now, later, there was a fellow from Virginia that was quite irate aboard ship that the colored, the blacks, were permitted to use the same barber. Use the same barber. So I said, now let me get this straight. They had to cut their own haircut. And he resented the fact that they even thought of maybe using the barbershop. And I told him, they come into the dental office, the same instruments are being used, so why couldn't the same tools be used in the barbershop? But just a little thing like that, you could sense that there were deep feelings. And if it was directed toward the black, you also knew that it was directed toward Jews, perhaps not as overtly. So you knew, as you went through life, you knew you were a Jew.
Okay.
Well, I was amazed. I mean, it was a constant repetition of anti-Jewishness.
Dr. Gordon, tell us about dentistry as it was when you first started practicing and as it has changed over the years and what you expect for the future.
When I started to practice dentistry, I was in 1934. We were just on the verge of new changes. The equipment that we used had the old four-cluster lights, similar to what you would find the balls hanging over a pawn shop. It was not the greatest illumination. We used a steel burr that was slowly driven. It was not high speed, it was low speed. So preparing teeth, cutting them down, was very arduous, very slow. Dentistry was difficult. And the men quit in droves. In fact, when I was at dental school, when I worked on the patients, my drill was run by a foot treadle, like a sewing machine. And you stood up and you pumped it. And you pumped it. And as the cord revolved, it turned the drill. So you were working at extremely slow speed, and it was not easy to make preparations. But the work itself was much better, much more accurate than what you find present day, in which the high speed is abused. I mean, they whittle down a tooth so fast, and a lot of the more refined methods are bypassed. It's just the same as comparing it to the artisans of today, as opposed to the artisans of years ago, where they were more meticulous, more crafted. Things today are fast to make money. Even the attitude has changed. It's more of a business. In my day, the dentist was like the physician. He attended every family affair, the weddings, the brisses, the baptismals, you accepted eggs in lieu of payment, or it was not money oriented. You were not driven to see how much you could make, and most professional men just didn't make that much. Of course, at all times you had people that were more monetarily aggressive, who perhaps not as ethical as they might be. So this has persisted at all times. But as a general rule, there was just pride in being a doctor, and that seemed to permeate your whole idea, your ideas, your ethics, your approach to your patient. There was a real good relationship. In my office on Center Avenue, sometimes before we would progress further with the work, we would stop, go across the street, shoot a game of pool, and then come back and continue with the dentistry. At night, I found myself often working for from 2 o'clock in the morning to daybreak because my office was next door to the famous Sandwich Inn where you could buy the most delicious corned beef sandwich for 10 cents. And it was like standing out in the middle of Broadway and there were so many people all night long. And as you'd be loafing there, someone would say, "Well, I have a tooth that's bothering me or something," and you'd open up the office and go in and start to work.
This was before you were married?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you didn't have unions in those days. So there was the working people, girls especially, they didn't have Saturdays off. And they worked late at night. So it was nothing for offices to be open till midnight. Sometimes you wouldn't even start till noon. This was the only way you could accommodate the working people. Later, of course, this all changed. Now, it was nothing for me to work early in the morning. Later on, as my practice increased, till dinner hour, go home and eat, and then come back and work till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. And this was sometimes 7 days a week. But again, on my part, I was not pursuing the dollar. I was just trying to accommodate my patients. And rather than jam them in and do work as hurriedly as possible, I expanded my hours like an accordion so that I could carefully accommodate them with good work. Materials have not changed greatly as far as basic gold and silver fillings, except that inlays were waxed in the mouth. Cast and inserted without benefit of any laboratory, outside laboratory procedure. In other words, you did it yourself. Now today, an indirect method is used in which the impression is taken, sent out to a laboratory, and you get it back and you insert it. It is not the same quality as persisted.
You're saying that you did all your own lab work then in the beginning?
Inlays. In other words, inlays, we were taught at school to make a wax pattern in the mouth. Mm-hmm. In other words, after preparing the tooth with that slow drill, you press the wax into that space, shaped it, carved it, and then you removed it. And then you did your laboratory work in your own office, and then you inserted that inlay. You could take a pin-edged instrument and move it around the margins, and if the margins weren't perfect so that that instrument could glide over, a fine dentist would do it over. This is non-existent today. And that work was being done at perhaps $15. And years later, I was doing it $25. So actually, we were giving it away. I was associated with Dr. Zugsmith, who had been getting a fee of $25 for maybe 50 years before I came into the picture. and he was continuing to service his patients at that same fee. And foolishly or otherwise, I continued the same way. But it was painful. It was hard. I took my wife down to Mayo Clinic for a checkup, and while I was there, I thought I would be checked, because at times I would come home and I'd have a pain across my chest, and I thought perhaps I was having heart troubles. And they told me I was just literally working too hard, that these were muscular pains, and I should take it easy. So, to be repetitious, as I say, dentistry was hard, and then we graduate school, practice for a year, close up, and go into something else. They just quit. Now, impression techniques have changed greatly. That's a big advance that allowed for the indirect procedures where you could send it out to the laboratory, the alginates, which are almost like sponge-like in quality. In fact, they use alginates when they display baked goods in windows to keep it from caving in. So this would give you an impression which was elastic, and it would spring back to its natural shape. Prior to that, you had to take impressions in plaster. And you had to section them. We used a tray that would split, and you'd have sections, and then you could piece it together. And